Blog Talk Radio.
All right. Good morning, everybody. Good morning. Welcome to Behind the Blue Curtain. I got some of my favorite people here. Some normals, Chief Devlin and Chief Mosley. Got some weekend stuff that they got to do, but that's okay because we still have enough police officers in the house to be able to handle any questions people may have on policing. Good morning, Billy Brown. So what we're going to do, this topic really came up, and how we do it is we kind of chart and graph, and we look, and we all talk, and we come to a consensus. What are some things in policing that need to be discussed? And it's not always the bad stuff, you know, it's not. So what I want to do this morning is talk about, you know, street credibility. It's something that's not, oftentimes, the community doesn't always understand it. The police see it, but sometimes with the conditioning and training we go through for ego, we tend to want to fit in with the ego more than what's going to get us through in the job and up on survivability. And we got our newest, we're going to start with the newest co-host, y'all. I'm going to tell you, this is my baby girl. This is my daughter, Claire Van Wolf, her pilot show. Good morning, dear. How you doing?
What's up? Good morning. Hey, yeah, I have something I want to say about that, actually. So I've only had 2 years on the force. I decided not to pursue the career. However, I did have my 2 years. And as far as street credibility, I wasn't there long enough to be able to say that I built enough street credibility. I do understand the importance of it. However, it wasn't taught to me in my academy nearly as much, I think, that should be harped on.
Oh, yeah, and that's something we're going to go into. I'm going to drop down, say, what's up, John? Big John.
Hey.
Oh,
which one?
Oh, yeah, because I got two John. I got to go with John R. today.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. Looking forward to a special show. Glad to have our new co-host on. My brother, Izzy, always ready to hold it down. So I'm looking forward to hearing from our special guest. One of them I'm really interested in because of the martial arts background of my family. And I want to be able to chop it up with him and see what I can pick his brain for. But all together, it's going to be an exciting show. Let's rock and roll.
All right, brother, as always. You know, it's going to be good. And probably I'll get to Fred when I get to him because that's homeboy right there. So, Big Izzy, what's going on? A lot going on in your life, bro, these days.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Happy to be here. Yeah, I'm ready to get into it. Just storying on the policing schools. I'm about 3 weeks away from my wedding. Start grad school this week.
All right, bro. Let me go up, you guys. This guy y'all see up in the upper left corner as I look at my screen. You know, I know people would think, okay, you want to talk about street credibility. You want to talk about the importance of having a reputation in the street. This guy don't look like it. Well, you know, when you're out there doing the job, and I want to speak to officers right now more than citizens, because one of the things I found from my experience, the citizen didn't care what color the officer was. They didn't. How you treated them is what was up front. And this guy, you know, hello, Waco, y'all going to feel me, Parkside, the Villages, Sherman Manor, Trimwood, Estella Maxey, South Terrace. I'm talking about the 90s, the straight-up war zones. This was my ride or die. When I checked out to go walk through there, he come over the radio. Where you parked that, Stan? I'm coming. And he actually really, he built a very successful reputation in Waco as being fair. He's hard as hell. He'll come get you. John will come get you. John A., he come get you. And when he stopped and asked about you, ripples went down through the pipeline of all the people doing that. But he never got the, he's a racist, and he's doing this. Why? Because everybody in the hood knew John, or who they knew him by, was every cop has a nickname. He was either Glasses or Poindexter, but he was cool with it. That was how people in the hood related to him. So, you know, without further ado, good morning, John. Appreciate you making time to be here, bro.
Thanks, Dan. Thank you very much. Always glad to be on your show, and I want to thank you again for all you've done for my cause, Armor Up America, Safe Call Now, and Sean Riley. So, again, thank you for helping us with getting our message out.
All right, brother. Now I got to go down to the man. This is a bad man. I told you I was going to say that on the show. This is a bad man right here. You guys, I put some of his credentials in the posting of the show. Fred Waters, I'm so proud of this brother. You know, I mean, and you may think, why do we have a martial artist here? Why would we, what does he have to do with this topic? Very easy. Officers, I'm talking to you. Very humble guy. Very disciplined guy. Very quiet guy. But when we go out there and operate in the ego, we never know who we're dealing with and who's capable of doing what to us. So at that point, I want to say good morning to Dr. Fred Waters. And, brother, take a little bit of time and introduce yourself and let everybody know a little bit about you.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. It's an honor to be on your show, man. You know, it's something you never dream about when you're younger. But, you know, you follow the right path, you get opportunities. A little bit about myself. I've been in martial arts for now like 48 years, coming up on 49 years in martial arts. I studied Okinawan style Isshinryu. I went into the military where I had the pleasure of learning or studying Chinese boxing, judo, hapkido, wudo. I mean, I studied a lot of different styles because every time you PCS, you go somewhere else and you start over. And I find myself always starting over as a white belt. No matter what color belt I had before I went in, I went to another instructor, I had to start at the bottom, which when I was young, I didn't care. I had fun. And I studied with a lot of different guys in the military doing martial arts. And fast forward up to 1990, my instructor, I got with him through my wife, her friend, and he was in Taekwondo. He trained special forces in the military. And he got big medallions from President Clinton. He got all kinds of awards, a former world champion. And I went to my first fight. It was, my first fight, 1991, Ocean City, Maryland. First fight. I hadn't fought nobody. Went there, won the world championship. I won that as a brown belt. By me winning that, I was eligible to try for the U.S. Olympic team. So I made, that was in like, oh geez. Yeah, look, I'm getting old, I can't remember. I know I got promoted after a brown belt. My instructor told me, he said, well, you won the world championship. It's time for you to move up a notch. So I got my first green black belt. Then I went on and tried out for the Taekwondo team for the U.S. Olympics because they had the state championships down in Maryland. And I went down to Maryland, I took second place in the heavyweight division. And I'm going to tell you what, that was rough. I was so doggone tired. So I knew I was going to go try out for the Nationals and down in Hampton, Virginia. So I went down there. Well, before that, I trained. I started running. I was driving track and trailers at the time. So it was hard to train working 12 hours a day, sometimes 13, 14 hours a day. So I went down there to Hampton, Virginia, got my butt kicked. But it was a good experience. From then on, I'm a 9-time Hall of Famer. I have trained military in close-quarter combat weapon disarming. I specialize in disarming weapons. I don't teach people how to shoot. I teach people how to disarm weapons. And I used to run hand-to-hand combat with Armed Forces Day here in Harrisburg. I also taught up at the U.S. Army War College, teaching close-quarter combat and weapon disarming. So that's what I do. I help women, teach women, children. I taught some police officers, not all, because a lot of them think that they don't need the type of training. And the part that I know we're going to be talking about is the use of force. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to jump ahead and scare you, but that's my background. I've done movies, models, commercials. I'm a married guy. I eat apple pie and ice cream and cake. And I enjoy life. And I'm retired.
Man, bro. He's done more retired than most people going to do in 2 or 3 lifetimes. But I want to jump straight into this. And I want to go straight into the fire. Because, you know, a lot of good people doing this job. And you come in and we all see the roses and we don't really see what the job of policing entails until you hit that street. I don't care if dad was a cop or uncle was a cop. When you hit it for yourself and dad ain't there, you're stuck there with people in need, anger, violence, problems that you can't solve. There are no mechanisms in place. Anyway, how do you balance all of this? You know, and it's good because I have Claire here, I have Izzy here, I have John here, and Claire, being, you're really great because me and John are old school. We just are. But you have that fresh mindset, that thought. The world has moved. We need to upgrade how we do things. You're going to be important. But I want to go over to Izzy up front, and I want to ask and then get his thoughts. What is it about survivability and street credibility that he thinks, and he's an investigative journalist, so I know he's talked to a lot of people. What's your thoughts on this, Ed?
On street cred?
Yeah. Well, how important is it for an officer to be able to have recognition in the street, to be respected, not because of violence or a badge or a gun, but where their presence doesn't stir things up?
I mean, I think if all these police departments around the country are going to be promoting this idea of community policing, that's kind of the basic tenet of it. And the reason behind it is because if you are supported by the community, if you know the community, it leads to being able to do your job better. You're able to solve crimes better. You're able to get information better. You're able to pursue the tenets of the profession with greater ease if you are a part of that community and if the community trusts you. One of the major problems that's happening with police departments around the country right now is that a lot of communities don't trust their police forces anymore, which is leading to problems with solving crimes and problems with doing the job, because if the community that you're working in doesn't trust you, they're not going to come to you and talk to you if a shooting happens. They're not going to explain to you what happened. You're not going to get your eyewitnesses. You're not going to get your informants. And I think it's a necessity of the profession.
Now I take what you just said, which is, as I didn't want to say it, I wanted it to come from you. And I'm going to go up to John A. for a minute, because I think for the officers listening, and who will never comment, but some of them, a lot of them listen to the show, and they can agree or disagree, but this is, I think, the one thing when I talk about street credibility. I'm not just talking about moving around drug dealers, murderers, and thieves, being able, John Ruffin down the corner, the co-host, said something a few shows back, and he said it several times, is that officers get to go home because the community let them go home. Not your badge or your gun or your authority or your backup or your tactical skills. There's somebody moving around you that doesn't like you just for what you do. They don't know you. And you went home because they let you go home. So when the other side of that is to the officers, everything we do, you have to have a trial to have an outcome. In these trials often, there are these people called jurors. These jurors are made up from the community. What is your reputation in that community? Do they walk into the jury room and say, I don't know this guy, I've never heard of this guy, I've never heard of that guy? Or do they walk in and say, I know something about this guy. He did a food drive. He helped my daughter. He went to my kid's school. He did so. I see him. I've seen him in HEB or wherever shopping. When you have that type of rapport with that juror, don't think those jurors don't talk. And when you're up there testifying and they're hearing you, and defense attorneys will go, we better look for a plea deal. This guy is known in the community. He or she is transparent. The community recognizes them. They gravitate towards them. You're making my job harder. I can't guarantee. So the street credibility for me, it really pays off. I want to go over and get John A. Brother, you did narcotics for a long time.
For those that may not know me, I just recently retired from the Waco Police Department after 25 years. Real quick, 20, 21 of those, I was spent I had different jobs, but for the most part, I was in the minority community, the black community in Waco. So I first went to work for the PD in early 96. First assignment they gave me was a patrol beat in the north side. I worked that. I went to K-9. As a K-9 officer, although we worked citywide, we still divvy up the city into different areas where it's our patrol areas. Again, back in either north side or East Waco, working K-9. Went to narcotics, undercover work, again, north side, east side. And so the overwhelming majority of my career, I spent, and some of it by choice, in those socioeconomically depressed minority communities. And one thing I learned very early in my career, and I didn't even have to learn it. It was actually how I was raised, and that is everybody is somebody, and everybody has value, regardless of who you are or your skin color or whether you got $1,000 in your pocket for 50 cents. None of that matters. It's the person. And I thank my dad and my parents both for instilling that in me from the earliest ages. And it paid off very well for me when I was policing, simply because I was able to use that background. And it doesn't matter who you're talking to. If they're hustling on a street corner, they're hustling on a street corner, right? They're still a person. They're still somebody with family and friends. And while you may not agree with what you're doing, they still have self-value. And if you don't communicate with people, if you don't take the time to learn who you are and where you fit in the community and the community itself, you're never going to be able to succeed in your line of work. If you deal with somebody two or three times a month and you take the time to talk to them, you learn who their brother is. You learn who their mother is. You learn who their family is. And that is a powerful tool, not only to be able to get information from the street, forget information from the street for a minute. If you walk up on a corner and you call somebody out by name and you start talking to them, even though you're on opposite sides of the fence, I'm there to enforce the law, they're working their hustle. You call them out by name and you start talking to them and you say, hey, how's your mom, Miss So-and-so, been? Or, hey, I heard your brother got jammed up the other day. You know, if he needs something, he can give me a call. Reach out to me. Maybe I can help him out. You make that connection. Skin color leaves the building at that point. Because now you're two people having a conversation about life, about where they're at and what they're doing. And you're able to get to them and talk to them. I've told many a person, put them in the back seat of the car. Hey, bad day today. We ended up on opposite sides of the fence, but holler at me tomorrow. I might buy you a Coke. You know, if you see me out, say, hey, I'll buy you a Coke. We'll talk about it. That takes you into places that you can't even imagine as a
person. Absolutely.
It takes an extra 30 seconds or a minute. So to say you don't have time because your call load's off the chart, you're not being honest with yourself. There's another reason why you're not doing that. It is literally 30 seconds or a minute. Or if they got jammed up and they're in the back of the car, doesn't sound right, but they're a captive audience for the ride to jail, you can talk to them about anything. And so there is always a place for you to be able to connect with your community. And the situation may not be right. Hey, so you may put somebody in the back of the car, they might be running hot. you know, it might be F you and F your mama and everything else. Mm-hmm. But if you just stay quiet and let that burn out of them, they're going to get to a point where you say, hey, man, I know you're throwing at me like that, but it's about respect. I'll respect you, you respect me. You know, let's, you know, this is about always about us. And I never, over all of those years of policing, that came back to me a thousand times over in a good way.
Mm-hmm. And John, let me, because I'm going to go to John R. on your point, because what you just said was really important, because even when that person in the back of your car didn't like you, for me, they weren't at war with me. They were at war with the city of Waco, not me. They didn't know me. But what was, the thing is, when you go into the booking area and you go back into the blocks, everybody's putting on the show in the booking area, you know. But when they go back into the wings back there, you know, and everybody, first thing everybody wants to know is who brought you in. See, this is where street cred comes in. This guy who doesn't know you, that hates you, that has nothing good to say about you. But when you go back to who brought you in, Mason. Oh, man, Mason, cool. What did you do? How did you treat him on the way in? See, there's repercussions. Believe, and folks may not believe what I'm going to tell you. John, if I'm lying, I'm getting ready to go to you. You talk about it. When you disrespect an officer who has credibility in the street or in the jail, there is repercussions that you face on behalf of the inmates. Now, we're having that real talk today. Big John, talk to us, bro.
Yes, sir. I got to call John, man. John, I'm going to ask him before you start to define what is credibility from an officer perspective, but pretty much he did it on his own. And I just want to just touch on a couple things. The two biggest mistakes that I see a lot of officers make coming into the community, one is that they think that respect, because they got on this uniform, that I have to be respected. Yeah, it's a given thing because of the uniform. But as John knows, you know, that it's earned. You earn it. And the second thing, mistake is, the biggest mistake to me is that a lot of officers don't believe that criminals deserve justice. So when the guy who's been known as the drug dealer or the guy who does burglary, he ends up getting shot, doing robbery, do something. I'm not going to follow up. That guy's a piece of crap. You can't look at people in that manner. And I think John laid it out that, you know, everybody deserves justice. Everybody deserves to be protected within his job description. So I think you hit it on the head. So let me just get into some of the things that, just one or two things. I learned to respect those officers that would come by and be like, say to my guys, hey, where Big John at, man? Some man of war came out. Nobody want to kick his mom's door in. Nobody wants to go kick his baby mother's door in. Hey, man, tell him, man, I get off at 4 today, man, and be coming in. Boom, I see what we could do about the bond, this and that, whatever. That's good credibility. Because you're not coming here to clear up my mother's house. You're not coming here because it becomes a personal thing now. When you start kicking down doors, mm-hmm. You know I got court, just dealt with it differently. So when Big John down below, he's below on my screen, when he comes out or he knocks on my mother's door and says, hey, tell John, if you see him, if he come by today, stop by them. We got warrant for his arrest, motor vehicle, baby mother complained about something small. And you deal with it, like me. Yes.
And that's the thing
that's
about
it. That's right. Keeping the lock right there. Keeping the lock right there.
And what we're talking about is credibility. So that builds up credibility for him. And for me, because here's the thing. When John comes in and he hears, hey, Sam, what's going on out here? Cliff, what's going on out here? And Big John is going off then, and hey, let me go in and talk to him. I can calm him down. So now John A comes, hey, Big John, man, I know you need it, man. Let me talk to you, man. We got to bring you in. And I talked to my captain. I'm going to put you in the back of my car. I'm going to cuff you, so you don't have to worry about the cuffs being uncomfortable. And one thing you're going to do, when you cuff me, you got room in there, be straight, be not too tight.
Double lock.
I've seen cuffs where I've seen marks in my vest for days. So this is all part of building this relationship, this credibility. And the last thing I'm going to say, and I'm going to get off the podium, is for the officers coming in the community, you have to know this. They are community leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not talking about
preacher,
Al Sharpton, the church leaders. I'm talking about the elders. There's a mother of that community. Every community has a mother.
Yep.
That
yep.
She's the mother for every family in that community. And that might be Miss Johnson. She sits on the porch and she can say, boys, I'll take that down the street. There's no boys in that neighborhood would listen to her. Hey, don't do that to that officer. You only get, you build your relationship with her. And then there's always one guy in the street that you have to break that ice with, because now he controls. And I'm going to tell you something. I don't know if I ever told you this. The reason why a lot of the gangs built were allowed to come together in prison, because DLC had the idea of easier to control 10 to 20 heads than it is to control a population of 5,000 inmates. Now, this guy right here controls 400 inmates. So if we break ice with him, we automatically have control. And I'm saying that in the sense of where good policing is, well, I know this guy runs the block. He's the guy you talk to. He's the guy that everybody respects. Even if he's not in the game no more, everybody respects him. And if he's be that, if he has credibility, he's got that credibility in the streets. So if people see that this guy is credible, is talking to me, John A., or Stan, or Claire, then automatically my credibility is being lifted.
Now, John, before I go to, I'm sorry.
And I'm going to shut up on that.
No, no. Before I go to Dr. Fred and then finally Claire to stitch all of our old school arguments together, I want to ask you this, John. If you would, you don't have to. It's up to you. But you told me a story that right now there's some officers somewhere in America that's pulled over listening to this show. Whether they like the show, don't like the show, like me or any of the guests, I really don't care. You're here, you know. Yeah, but and they're wondering. They're on that fence. They see they're human. What they're taught isn't always working. The IME syndrome that all cops go through. When you hit that 7-year mark, you're just greater than life. And you had an interaction with one of your gang members, associates, whatever, who was ready to drop a lieutenant before he made that move. If you want, you can leave names out or do whatever you want to do. But it's important that officers today working and people who want to come into this understand that they're not always in control. They can be in authority, but that doesn't mean you're in control. But can you tell that story?
Yeah. One night we was at the, Mobile Mart. And as I was coming out, he was like, yo, man, come on. I was like, what up? It was like, now there's really like two carloads of us. They said, yo, guess who? That light right there, about to be on the highway. And I said, yeah. And they said, that's Lieutenant Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
And this dude, then he looked at my hood, especially me, personally. He had a personal thing with me. And we jumped on the highway. And he had a Jeep Wrangler with the top off. and one of the guys took a bang and pointed and could have smoked him. And I said, yo, great, don't do it. Don't do it. I said, nah, nah, nah. The highlight that night was like, it was just us. It was just us. We could easily hit him in, and that was been it. But I also thought about, I forgot those videos they like because I liked them or whatever the case may be or whatever. I know that I was in the mobile mark. I know that there's cameras in the mobile mark, and they're going to track back times of who was at the mobile mark and kind of like the scene of the crime type thing, what time is supposed to. You guys know how you got to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that played a major role in the decision, but that cop was not close to being murdered and not even know it. And I'm going to tell you another thing, Stan. It was another incident where one was sitting in the movie theater and dudes had guns on him. Said, yo, that's that cop right there. And he was with his girl. I said, man, leave that shit alone. We went and sat. And he was sitting like two or three rows in front of us at the movie theater. And it probably was 20, 25 guys, you know what I mean? And we was all beefing with dudes. So we all strapped up. And that dude could have lost his life right there in that movie theater along with his girlfriend. You know, it was like, yo, leave that shit alone, man. Leave him alone. He'll suffer. And we just moved to a whole other section of the movie theater. And he don't even realize he could have lost his life.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Fred.
Hey, Stan.
Yeah.
Let me jump in real quick. John R. brings up a huge point that I think a lot of officers don't necessarily grasp, maybe earlier in their career. You're only in a uniform 8 or 10 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
You have a personal life with your family. And you are interacting in a community where you're policing. And you know exactly what I'm about to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of the number of times I went to a shopping mall and somebody came up. I would be with my wife. And people would come up and say, hey, Glasses, how are you? You know, glad to see you out. And to be like, hey, you know, your wife's real pretty or whatever. But you are always interacting with those you police. And you know, you get that cliche, well, we're the police are the biggest street gang in the world. And you know what? That's all fine and dandy, but if you antagonize those you police, it really don't matter how big your gang is if you're in the ground. You know, you can say, well, you know, I got other people looking out for me even if you do something. It doesn't do you any good because, you know, you got dirt thrown on you. So it's important for people to understand that, man, I honestly can't think of the number of times, but it's a crazy number where I would be out somewhere with my family, and even people that were doing big wrongs, they would still come up and say, hey, Glasses, man, hey, glad to see you out, or hey, you know, they would acknowledge me in some way, but it'd be in a positive manner. Man, you got to stop. If that really made an impression on me, it made me step back and go, okay, you know, we're all in this together. And the other important part that John R. threw out there is exactly right also. It doesn't matter if there's one of you working in your area or five of you working in your area. You're in, there are always going to be people around you that they use their own mindset to restrain themselves from harming you. You can't, you know, someone's always behind you, watching, paying attention. So it's important for officers to realize that if they don't build some street cred in the communities that they work, when they take that uniform off, they are still citizens in their community. And there are always going to be people around that have judged you based on your conduct that may choose to do you harm or treat you with respect and give you a shout out at the mall. That's something that only you as an officer control. Nobody else controls that.
Okay, now since we're talking about control, and emotions and whether to react or not react. And I have an advantage here, a distinct advantage. Do I employ my advantage or do I not? Dr. Fred Watts, I want you to chime in on what you've heard. You and I had a discussion yesterday, and you posed a very poignant question to me. If you remember what that question was, you know, brother, you got the floor, and then we're going to go down to Claire. We're going to let you stitch this all together. Come on, Doc.
Okay. The one thing that always bugs me is what do you do when if you've done nothing wrong and a cop starts abusing you? Now, like I was telling Stan yesterday, I was on my way to teach a class last year, and I never had a panic attack in my life. I don't worry about nobody. It's not because I'm not invincible. But I was running the speed limit, doing what I'm supposed to do. All of a sudden, I got scared. And for me to get scared, that's a little strange. And I started looking in the mirror, and that was one of the things that bugged me. So what do you do? If I'm, just say, for instance, I was speeding. Just say if I was speeding, cop pulls me over. All right, I can handle a ticket. I don't care. If I do something wrong, I can live up to it. But then he starts hitting on me. What, you know, and with my background, that's the best thing to talk about. There's a lot of things that I could do, but I might win a fight, but I'm not going to win the war.
Uh-huh.
So what can I do if an officer starts beating on, and I'm talking actually for everybody, it's like me, or anybody who don't have the skills. What can you do when an officer starts fighting you? If you fight back, what's going to happen? Besides, you get shot. So what can you do to protect yourself? So if I disarmed him and handcuffed him, what would happen to me?
You'd be shot. You'll be shot. So I think the question becomes, when do we move from what is considered legal restraint or appropriate force into what is police brutality? And that line is so blurred because it's by perception of most of the jury or the makeup of the community. And I understand what you're saying, because if we look at Carol Horn and what happened with her, it took her 15 years as a Buffalo police officer to get her benefits because she stopped an officer who was out of control choking another man. It took her 15 years to get what she earned. I'm talking about you're fired, you're disgraced, you're dishonored. And it's not to say all officers are that way, but it is to say, yes, we don't just have a few bad apples. In many places, the apple cart is right. Not that the orchard is bad, but the apple cart is right. So, you know, at some point, we got to acknowledge this problem, and we have to put protections in place for the good men and women who are going to speak up instead of them being thrown to the wolves and ostracized is why you get involved and we're a blue family. That is bullshit. And we have to start calling out wrong the way it is. If you got to take darts, now we're tough and we're cops and we're all these things, then you do the right damn thing. Not when it's just the right time to do it. Come on, John.
This dude just asked a magnificent question.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to throw this at you, John and Claire. Y'all good officers. If you get a call over the radio and you get there and you see Dr. Fred struggling with an officer, whether the officer on top or Fred is on top, immediately you go into what mode? What mode?
That's my life.
Oh, yeah. You're getting involved. Yeah, you're getting in. You're going to go up there. You always got to side with the blue side until you get it sorted out.
Mm-hmm.
It just is that way.
That's the thing.
What happens? Do what? Close question.
By the time you get it sorted out, what happens to Fred?
Fred's going to get handcuffed. Fred's going to get handcuffed on the ground until it's sorted out. That's the benefit of the doubt. So you got to look at it like this, John R. Right, I'm a police, the guy fighting the police. You got to give that officer in the fight the benefit of the doubt till you sort it out. You have to.
But
this is real talk.
And I'm going to go to Claire here in a second. But see, and John A. is right. But see, this is where I have the conundrum in it, is that while John A. is right, Stan's going to do the same thing. Fred's going in handcuffs. Because if he understands that I'm no longer choking him or kicking him, I'm putting him in handcuffs and I'm getting somewhere, that's one thing. Now, here's where we fall short on all this. Do the departments, do the clear concise, and transparent follow-up in an investigation the way it should be done. And I don't think the community is always so much outraged at all of the officers' actions as they are the follow-up investigation, the lack of transparency, the lack of a conviction. You know, if somebody, if me and John A. were walking through the projects, if I come around the breezeway and somebody's beating John A., I'm beating somebody's ass. Are we going to go to whatever level we have to get to? Now, if you respect me, we're talking street cred. You respect me, when I show up, you ought to be putting the brakes on, especially if you were selling dope. You ought to be putting the brakes on. And then we weed it out from there. But if, as an officer, whether I like this officer I'm working with or whether I don't, if I come around that corner and they're fighting with somebody, Stan doesn't have the time to really say, hey, guys, what are y'all fighting about? Because I don't know. And if that guy gets John A's gun, Stan don't know if Stan's going to be shot. So we're talking street cred. And John, I talk to you. I tell you, I there's people on here from Waco will tell you, we've had guys I put in jail for dope. I could go to their house and say, I want everybody outside. Everybody came out and sat on the porch by myself, strapped. And I could say, y'all need to knock this off or that off. Guess what? They knocked it off. Not because I was the police, but they respected what I was doing. So you have to really take in, I got to react to what it is. I got to stop the aggression. That's the number one rule. Stop the aggression first. But then with the same energy and enthusiasm you put into fighting for the blue or fighting for the sit, whatever, have enough forethought to sit back and say, I don't know what happened. I know what I saw and figure out what happened. Let me go to Claire real quick.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. John R., you asked the question, and I wanted to give you my perspective because you asked, what would you do as an officer if you showed up on a call and, like Fred said, what do I do if I get pulled over and I get hands on me for seemingly no reason? Well, I tell you what, if you show up and John A. is on the ground with you, the first thing I'm going to do as an officer is protect that other person, okay? Now, that doesn't mean I'm not protecting John R. or I'm not protecting Dr. Fred, but I know that John A. has been on calls with me. I work with John A. a lot, and I know that he has my back, and this is my job, okay? But I'll tell you what, after I get you in handcuffs and I make sure you're all right, I'm going to have a conversation with both of you.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I would police. Because like Sam said, I don't know what happened. But I'm going to be fair and I'm going to be honest. And I'm going to tell you, if you're fighting somebody, I'm going to stop it. Because like Sam said again, if you get his gun, we're all done. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
But I know for damn sure you're going to either point it at John, the one you were fighting, and then you might turn to me because I have the same uniform on. So I'm going to stop the fight. Because I don't want that to happen. But I'm
going
to ask both sides, hey, what's going on?
And that's
the problem.
Go ahead, Dr. Fred. Let me get Dr. Fred real quick.
Okay. That's the problem because the citizen could be totally right. But when it goes in before the judge and everybody else,
there we go.
Still will be convicted. Mm-hmm. So that's my point. And that always bugged me. What do you do? Because if I go report this guy, nothing happens. We'd check into it. Nothing happened. I had an incident that happened to me. Dr. Fred,
I'll just interject 1 second.
Uh-huh.
That is a popular viewpoint from those outside of law enforcement that nothing ever happens. Let me guide you towards something that the state of New Jersey just did in the last week. Every officer disciplinary action. It was a state law that was enacted, and they just began the reporting process. It is every officer's disciplinary record and every officer that was terminated. You can now look at online. Anybody can log on to the website and look at online. I think you would be surprised at the number of officers that were disciplined or terminated just in the state of New Jersey. Now, I am not defending the system, but what I am saying is the misconception that nothing ever happens to an officer for misconduct, I've logged onto that website, It's a very lengthy website to show that officers were fined, were given days off, there's a lot of disciplinary action that takes place that people don't hear about.
But when did that start, John? I mean, what year?
Now, that's just, the law just passed. And that
See, that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the past. Now, I've never been in jail, never been arrested for anything in my life. I'm just talking in general for what I've seen, and I see things that happen. I know good cops, and I'm not a cop hater because I've got very, very good friends that are in law enforcement.
Right.
I will go down with them any day and any time. Certain cops. Now, I won't back every cop.
No, you're right.
I won't back bad cops.
Okay, but that's what I'm saying right now.
Yeah, so if they just started, that's great. But in the past, I've seen bad cops do bad things, and I was scared to say something when I was in the military. But I seen it with my own eyes. I seen it when I was a kid. Another cop, a black cop, saved me from getting shot because I would have had a beef with some guy with a girl. You know, when you're a teenager, you do dumb things. I didn't even know I was I had a lead bullet aim for my head. I never knew it till the cop told me. And man, it was good friends. So, you know, that's what I'm saying. So, as it started now, that's great.
That's their tool. When I talk about what New Jersey is doing, and I hope other states follow suit,
mm-hmm.
they're listing their disciplinary record. If they've been on the force 20 years or 25 years, they're listing everything for the last 20 or 25 years.
And, John, and I think that's great. If I can stitch in a little bit before I go back to Claire, what both of you are saying, I applaud that they're doing that. But I'm also going to say, stop letting them go down the street and get hired somewhere else. Ban them from the profession. So, and I also have to say, you know, me, you, and Claire are the resident cops on the show. I got to say, we have all had that call where we walk the streets and been over there and get along with everybody, but you're getting called, and that one person is getting sent to back you. We don't need to call no names, but let's get real. And you know, my ass is going to be in the wind because this person, with the minute y'all get on that car and they go, I'm going to go over here for a minute, you're thinking in your mind, oh, Jesus Christ, we're going to have a riot. Send everything you got because of that person's attitude and mentality. And I'm only speaking from what I know in the department I was at. These are some of the same people who hold glorified positions, hold favoritism, poster children for everything. Their heroes are some of the same people who you got to bring everybody from every district that's not on a call for something that's 3 hours later, when we whittled through it, nobody had to be there for that. That hero syndrome. So I'm applauding the progress, but I'm saying that, and it's not to the individual officers who sometimes, there are some who say, everybody's got my back, so I'm going to do and say what I want to do and say and make it personal, because when it blows up, not only are we going to get a bunch of arrests, but I get to come out of it as the good guy. And I've seen it. It happens. And particularly with Claire, as a female doing the job, you're hated because you're a female there resented for that. So you, Claire, I'd like you to say how you feel about that without any specificity, because you bring a certain amount of expertise to this issue when we talk about street cred out there. Because you had to get, me and John had to go build street cred out there. John's attitude professionally was a lot like mine. I didn't give a damn who liked me and didn't like me in the workplace. For you, it was a little different because you had to battle things we didn't have to battle. You had to be somewhat respected before you even got to the problems on the street. So how did you juggle all of that, and how do you see it, this topic today?
I tell you, the number of times I thought about it when you told me what the topic was going to be, I thought about it, and the number of times I've showed up on a call that some man has said, suck my dick. The first thing mm-hmm. that comes out of his mouth when I walk up. I don't know if it's the way I look, if it's the way that I talk, if it's my presence, or if it's the fact that I'm a woman in uniform, but the fact that that's the first thing that's said. Now, how do I handle this? Well, I don't get pissed off, that's for sure. That's like the worst thing you want to do. But you want to talk to them. You want to be like, all right, listen, if you're going to respect me, then I'm going to respect you. But if you're not, then we can go down that path, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to put up with it, all right? Now, that's the first thing. As far as street cred. And that'll get usually. That would get in the back office and be like, all right, listen, all right, now I'm going to listen. Because obviously she actually has something to say, not just a mouth. You understand? So a street cred as far as a woman is totally different. Because, like John R. said, you can't just call him out and say, hey, let's talk about this like men. You know, I turn around, I'm going to put you in handcuffs. No, that's not going to work with me. So I guess more of my question was, when John R. brought that up, what do you do as a woman? What do you do as far as street credibility with somebody like you? I'm going to your mom's house, and I'm going to be respectful, but I'm going to call you out and say, hey, this guy has a warrant. What do you do? Because I'm not Johnny. I'm not a man. I'm not going to come out and be man-to-man with you.
I think it's not about gender. It's about level of respect. And we're talking street credibility. And that credibility covers so much. I'm going to wrap your question up with Dr. Fred's because John mentioned what Jersey is doing, but is it really something new? Is it really they created something? Even in the streets, if the Latin King came to me and said, yo, one of your brothers did something, I'd be like, okay, what happened? We had a little meeting on it. Okay. They go their way, we go our way. John comes in the community, hey, John, one of your men disrespected my officer. You know, I don't want to bring a team of guys down here. We talk this credibility. Or if I go to John or Claire, and I say, Claire, your partner did, you know, she said, okay, I'll speak with her. That conversation doesn't take place in front of me. But because I have earned John's and Claire's credibility, and they have earned mine, I know that when they walk away, that situation is going to be addressed. It may not be addressed in the manner in which I want it to be addressed. And this is what I'm saying. Even on a street level, somebody from another side of town said, one of my guys did something, I'm going to be like, yo, did you push up on this dude's wife? Yo, bro, listen, man, listen, shut up. I don't want to hear nothing. You're going to create a problem for both of us. And I'm going to leave you out there dry. So I'm going to handle my business. I'm not going to do it in front of you, Fred. I'm not going to do it in front of Claire or Izzy or John or Stan. I'm going to pull my guy to the side and deal with it. And a good officer is going to be the same. Now, Fred, if going back to you, because you hit something I think we need to stay there for a second. Because everybody's talking about, oh, I'm going to put Fred in cuffs, this and that. But there's going to be some more stuff that we're leaving out. You right over there, you sit right on top of the officer, and Fred was innocently attacked, but he's defending himself. There's going to be some swings on Fred. It ain't just simply throwing some cuffs on Fred. Let's talk about all of them. Now, my thing is, and I've seen it, and y'all correct me if I'm wrong. I remember a cop said one day, my brother was going to Lance. And the cop said, he said, yo, if it was John or TJ, I get it. They the rough ones out of the brothers. But him? You know what it takes to get him? I never seen him round up. See, once again, we're talking about street credibility. Mm-hmm. So John, this is when profiling is good in policing. When you know the individual, know what the capable is.
Exactly.
Know where the anger
right.
is taking.
There we go.
Go. This officer must have really did something for this guy to get like that. Say, John, I understand. Yes, I can see that happen. Does that make sense to any of you guys?
Yeah, it did. For me, it makes a lot of sense because, John, you know, if I walked up in the midst of all the stuff going on and I put my hands on Fred and I say, Fred, it's Stan. He knows who it is. He hears the voice. Man, I got this. Let's talk. Let's get this under control. But see, that Fred is only going to do that because he knows me, not because I have a badge or a gun. Now, I don't share a lot of stuff, but I'm going to share this. Back in the early 2000s, I took a couple of days vacation, living on North 6th Street in Waco. I, you know, come back off my vacation and find out that the sheriff's deputy or the marshals and everybody else has an arrest warrant out for a kid that lived two houses up from me that I knew. I found out it worked. So everybody, SWAT's been there, every beat officer, everybody wants to arrest a murderer. So, you know, get that attaboy. So I go over to his house and I knocked on the door. I was at work by myself. His mom comes. They all knew me. I lived two blocks or two houses down from him. And he's not here. The marshal's been here. I said, I know he's here. I said, look, bring him out. The only thing I want to do is get him to the jail safe because he's going to go to jail. That's going to happen. There's a warrant. Now, how are we going to do this? I know he's scared. Now, y'all know me. You can trust me, or you can trust whoever comes after me. They went in the house and brought him out. We sat on his front porch, on the front steps for a minute, and I explained everything that was going to happen. We're going down to the jail. You know, I had to call another officer to follow me to the jail because that was our policy. And we got down there. And I talked to him. I said, what happened? I won't go into details, but you know what? This kid told me what happened. And based upon what he told me, I was able to go out in 4 hours. 4 hours. And have people all over the street give me everything I needed. And from about 2009 to the time I left Waco. If this kid who has children now, I call him a kid, he's a grown man. If he saw me anywhere, in uniform or regular clothes, he would tell anybody in the street that was stopping and listening and say, I almost went to jail for the rest of my life. But Officer Mason believed in me. It's not to make Stan anything big, but it was the fact that this woman whose son is about to go to prison for the rest of her life had the marshals and everybody else banging on the door trusted me enough to risk, here's my son taken. And that kid trusted me enough to tell me all he knew. Now, was I a favorite among some of the detectives that were working that case? No, I was not. Why? Because you didn't arrest the right person. It wasn't a matter of whether Stan looked good or they didn't look good. It's because, A, they operated with the resources they had. They did not have, these particular people did not have trust in the street. They did not have respect in the street. So those people who knew what happened, that mother and that young man, were not going to talk to those officers because you weren't a person or an individual. You were a detective. And that's it. I'm telling you all, we've had, John, you know it, we've had drug dealers call this show that I put in jail that said on this show, we protected your house from all four sides of Waco. Not from each other. They wasn't worried about each other. They say you play the game fair. They knew where my wife at that time worked. They knew where my kids went to school. They had pictures of me in Houston at a local gym playing basketball. And they were told, you're taking drugs up there. If you get stopped, give up the load. Don't touch this guy. That, to the officers listening, you have no idea how far, you don't have to agree with their lifestyle. You can put them in jail. That's your job. But you have no idea how much street credibility does. You may meet this person 20 years later, and they say, you know, you took me to jail for a traffic ticket. I'm selling $1 million worth of dope a month. But you took me to jail on a traffic ticket 20 years ago, and you said this to me. Let me tell you what, today I'm working at Lowe's. I'm working at Home Depot. I'm working at Target. I got my grandkids. I'm not looking over my shoulder. I sat in jail. I changed my life because of what you did. And ain't nobody at the PD going to call you when you retire. Trust me, I know that firsthand. Well, they weren't calling me when I was still there. But they're not going to call you when you retire. But when those citizens come up and you review your policing career and what you did, and you want to know if you made a difference in the community, listen to the least of those people. Because that's where the answer is, right there. And I'm sorry, and we're open now, so anybody can chime in. We're not going to call on anybody.
Okay, let me hop in on this.
Come on, Doc.
And here's the biggest problem. You know, I think when the officers, when they go to school, when air cadets go to school to be an officer, it's the training, how they train them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I never was a police officer. I was going to be a police officer. I thought about it, and I changed my mind because I could not take bad orders. I'm not geared that way. I believe in helping people.
Mm-hmm.
But when you come into when you're a police officer, and you got that mentality that all black people are bad, all Hispanics are bad, you know, if you live in a certain area code, zip code, that they're bad. See, I think that's what happens is when they get that training. Now, maybe I don't know, like I said, I never was a cop. But when they hit the streets, if you treat, and this is my opinion, if you didn't have a weapon on you and you walked the streets, you would learn how to use verbal judo. You wouldn't know how to talk to people
mm-hmm.
and de-escalate.
Mm-hmm.
But, I look at a lot of these cops, and honestly, I meet some good cops, and I meet some cops, and if I seen them on the ground getting their butt whipped, I'd walk the other way. I spoke to a cop, back during, it was some type of box of terrorists or some goofy crap like that, and they had good cops at Costco, and I walked to a cop, and I was just like, hey, how you doing, man? One guy, he was like, hey, it's doing fine. I was like, I can't even want my business cards. Because I've trained a police officer. If he needs it, I trained a good police officer. I'm not training bad people. I've turned down money to keep training officers to kill. I was offered, these guys want to learn how to kill. I told you not to kill people. You can teach them. They want you to teach them. I said, I'm not going to do it. They should be doing non-deadly force. If it escalates or somebody has a gun, then you do what you got to do. But why slam elderly people down? Why beat up on people? Why have an attitude? I mean, you work for me. I'll pay your salary. You're my township. Or if a cop's in any township, they get paid by the citizens. Why do they have such, not every cop, I just want to make that clear. Why do they have such a chip on their shoulder like they're so tough and can't beat the weapon with a paper bag? You take away that handgun, you take away all authority, you take, and I'm quite sure they're bonded anyway. So if that's taken away, they would change their attitude. If they lost money, just like when I drove a truck, if I did something stupid and got time off, I didn't get paid. I lost money. That changed my attitude. When somebody pulled in front of me, hit the brakes, and I got an 80,000-pound truck, I couldn't just run over them. I go to Parisian and lose my house. I had more fear of my wife than I had to worry about losing my job because who's going to pay for the house? So there has to be consequences that are so severe that a cop would think, just like if I'm out in the street and I get into a beef with a guy, say, man, John R. gets in a beef, all right, and he hauls up and hits me and I hit him. And accidentally kill him, all right? I'm going to jail for life. Manslaughter, prison. So why are cops held to the same thing? If, you know, it's not you do as I, don't do as I do, you do as I say. They need to be held. If you start taking money out of their pension or 401s, that changes attitude. When you start losing some of that money, your attitude changes. When you talk to people, if two people have a beef, you're going to de-escalate.
Mm-hmm.
If you give me a ticket and I'm speeding and I'm mad, you know, and I'm like, oh, no, all this dumb stuff. If you tell me, look, I'm doing my job, that makes people think.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and most people now, you get some people that's going to be to an extreme. But everybody's not at the extreme that needs to be shoved around, talked down to,
mm-hmm.
treated like they're not worthless. Like you said up at the top, John A., everybody has a purpose. Everybody's worth something. That's somebody's child, that's somebody's kid, that's somebody's mom, dad, uncle, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But if we learn to treat people the way we want to be treated, things would be better. But you always want to have that 2 or 3 or 10% of people that's going to break the law no matter what. The speed limit could be 1,000 miles an hour. They want to drive 1,010. You know what I mean? Didn't cuss the cop out. I see that for myself. People do dumb things. And one time I seen this girl come in a one-way driveway in a market, block traffic after the cop comes, she's busting at the cop. But it tells you, do not enter. So you got certain people that, you know, you need to train officers more to be more psychologists a little bit or to know how to deal with people. Like, everybody shouldn't be a cop just like everybody should be a truck driver.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I look at it. Some people shouldn't even hold a gun license. Some people can't even walk and chew chewing gum at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So they need to screen them a little bit better. You know, I ain't gonna hold it up because I got so much. Let me
introduce this dynamic in.
Keep going.
Yeah, let me introduce this dynamic in, Doc, and I want you and Claire to exchange on this with John A. jumping in. This is Stan's personal opinion. Stan went through the academy moons ago, 92-93. Claire just came out of one relatively recently. This is my perception of taking in a lot of these accounts we see, researching these accounts, speaking to the mothers of the victims or the officers themselves, and a lot of this preparing for these shows. I believe, and you hit on something, but I believe that police academies today, policemen, number one, it's not a matter of community versus police, because police come from the community. Maybe not yours, but they come from a community. So we're not hatched somewhere in a laboratory with no concept of community. We have it. This is my problem with academies, is that we take normal functioning human beings and we teach them, I don't care if they're black, white, Hispanic, insert whatever race and religion and lifestyle you want in it. We teach them to be afraid of that which is different than them. Then we teach them to react to that fear, and we tell them, go here. Get this when you're scared. But we don't teach them the difference between being scared and being afraid. I went to things I was afraid of. But being afraid did not stop me from consciously thinking and moving. Being scared paralyzes you. So when we take officers who, before they became police officers, had no problem going to the movie theater, the nightclub, the grocery store, they didn't get out of their personal vehicle, and the first thing they grabbed was a flashlight to see the sidewalk. They didn't know what's underneath of them. But today, the first thing that's grabbed when they get out of the car in a well-lit neighborhood where people are filming with an iPhone and don't have any vision problems, the flashlight comes out. They're shining it all around. What are you scared of? Something's going to come out of the dark. Why? Because they sat in these training academies and heard hero stories from old school officers. They're always told that if you say hi, this person may say go to hell and do this. They're not told the person may just say hi. When we teach people to expect the worst in people, they're not going to be able to recognize the good people or, more importantly, the bad people the good people in a bad moment. There's only three types of people in this world: those that have been caught, those that are caught up, and those that haven't been caught yet. Everybody's one of them. Most of us are two. Some are all three. That's a hardcore life fact. But if you train good people to become afraid of that which is different, and then tell them how to react to that, and they follow it and say, well, I was in fear of my life. Nobody ever questions that part. Why? What was it? What was the weapon? What was the training? What was the dynamic? And that's black, white, or any other officer, and it's also citizens who say, because an officer walked up, I'm in fear. You don't know that man or that woman. You can't judge that man or that woman off of some Facebook video that you saw, because if that man or that woman in that uniform judges you on the call they just worked, you're going to say their profile. See, we can't have it both ways. So what do we have to do? We have to interact, conversate, have dynamics, be open to talking to people, not be afraid to meet that which is different. You know, and that's just me. Claire, John, it's open.
He left out the code word. So there's a difference when how the academies are structured when you and I went through and how they're structured now.
Mm-hmm.
Because even not long before I retired from the PD, I was working with the FTO program at the PD.
Mm-hmm.
So I was exposed to the new recruits that were coming out that were learning to be police officers. The key word in modern academies is threat assessment.
Mm-hmm.
Look at everybody and assess their threat level.
Yep.
That's the key word. Every person, every officer that's come through an academy in the last 10 years that's listened to this radio show just went, yep, that's the key word, threat assessment.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's a threat. What is their threat level? Their threat level. How are they going to act? How are they approaching you? How are they carrying themselves? Do they have, it's not, hey, people are people. People are a threat. And assess every person you come across for their
yep.
threat level.
Not
that neat.
That's
exactly it. That's exactly
come
it.
Come on, Claire.
It's on a scale from 1 to 10. it's on a scale from 0 to 5, but you're tied. As soon as somebody walks up to you, what's their threat level? Well, okay, an old woman, what's your threat level? An old man, what's your threat level? Okay, what's that mean as soon as they say something mean to you?
Mm-hmm.
What's the threat level now? Now, when asked if they said something bad, does it hurt your feelings? And that's really what you're taught. You're taught to be scared. And I'm telling y'all, I don't know how much education that the officers on this panel have, but education is key, y'all. Like Fred said, you need to have some sort of psychology, sociology classes, something to recognize that these are human beings.
Yeah,
that they have emotions and feelings, their family to go home to, just like you do.
Yeah. And here's the worst thing about it. I'm 6'1". They upset me every time I walk to a grocery store. Mm-hmm. People look at me when I walk up. A lot of times I wear shades. And that freaks people out. Now, how come, I don't like being stereotyped, but I'm keeping it real. A white guy could walk into a bank with shades on and have nobody think nothing about it. I walk in, I go to the same bank so they know me. All right? But I walk in, and the people are like, they get all scared. You know what I mean? If something happens, I'm going to be the one helping you. That happens. Threat assessment always happens to me. People look at me, and the first thing, nothing comes up, and my security. I get it. And this is the good part. They always think I work at the store where I'm at because I stay there, because I'm also an executive protection agent. I know I'm an executive protection agent. And I just sit there, and I've always got my head on the swivel in case somebody comes in. So either I get this, I'm chasing the place, or I'm security. And I had one lady say, hey, can you watch my car? And I got to go back. I said, I don't work here. She said, oh, I thought you were security. So, but that assessment, what you said is right. They always do that, but you can't judge a book by the cover. Mm-hmm. You got to get
Dr. Fred, the problem is it's taken to an extreme because the way the threat level is taught, they aren't just conducting a threat level assessment on you. They're doing a threat level assessment on your wife, your kids, your mama. Everybody.
Yes.
If an 80-year-old woman comes in with a walker, under the way things are taught now, the threat assessment is, well, yeah, she's 80 years old, but she's got a walker. She might hit me in the head with it.
It really is. That everything is seen as a weapon. You got a pen in your hand? Well, that can go in my eyeball.
But let's look at this.
Let me get in my 3-point stance to make sure I'm ready. That's true.
I mean, when we say threat assessment, and that's a great point, because we're going to go into the solution phase. See, I like that. Threat assessment. And we've all been taught it. I mean, I heard that this guy is just mad and helly. God lived 2 houses up from me. It speaks to me more than people I worked with. But threat assessment, what's the opposite of that? I come to John A. or I come to Fred or Claire or any of you, and I say, excuse me a minute. Now, while you're doing a threat assessment on me, if I came to you to interact with you, I have a need. See, there's another term called needs assessment. See, if we addressed the needs assessment, we would not have to deal with so many viral videos. Police chiefs wouldn't have to stand up and apologize. Cities wouldn't be getting sued to the bottom of the backside and beyond. Black folks wouldn't be fighting white folks. See, if we get down to, forget all your attachments, your blue attachments, your Christian attachments, whatever attachments you got. And for a moment, just deal with the person in front of you and say, out of all the people out there they could have interacted with, they picked me. Maybe I'm convenient. Maybe I'm not. Maybe they just thought I can talk to you. If we met people and dealt with people on their needs assessment first, every one of us in here was born with a degree of street sense, self-preservation. We're going to do the threat assessment. That's human nature. You're going to do it instantly. But when you carry it beyond to where you don't function to the need, what does this person want? What does this person need? Sometimes we miss our chance. And so what worked for me a lot for me was I know I'm going to a disturbance. I know everything's not happy in the house. It's 3 a.m. I know that. So when I go in, my first question is, why am I here? Not who called. Who called me was irrelevant. Why am I here? What can we do? How do we, not me, how do we fix this? These little questions, moving beyond the, like John said, the academy concept of threat assessment, when it becomes the basic program by which all policing functions happen, all policing contacts happen on a threat assessment basis. But I'm curious as to when the threat assessment gets implied. It never seems to come into play when we're with the elected officials. It never seems to come into play when we're with the rich folks. Only those poor folks in those certain neighborhoods where threat assessment becomes the modus operandi.
So I think where it really derails in the academy is they hyperinflate threat assessment. Mm-hmm. And here's what I'm talking about, and Clara will know exactly what I'm talking about. They will find a video a one-off event in South Florida and show it to a police academy at Waco PD and say, look, maybe it's an officer pulling up to a traffic accident, and this time in South Florida, somebody got out of a car and shot at the police officer. So they show that video and they say, see, you've always got to be on guard. You've always got to be doing your threat assessment, even if you're coming up to a traffic accident. And I'm not saying traffic accidents aren't dangerous. I'm not saying everything we don't do is dangerous. But academies take examples from across the country, one-off examples a lot of times, and use that as a tool to say, see, you've always got to be hyper-vigilant. You've always got to be conducting a high-level threat assessment, because this happened one time in Bangladesh. See, they got that officer. They got it. And the point being, yes, you have to be careful. It's no different than a lineman working an electrical line. You got to be careful in that electrical line because it'll kill you, right? But there's a difference between being aware and paying attention to your surroundings and being hyper vigilant for a threat.
And John, now when you
inject that mindset, you end up worrying about the 80-year-old woman with the walker. Maybe use that as a weapon against you.
Right. Okay, now let's, in your concept, I'm putting on my police officer hat for a minute, and we're going to go deep in this, that part of it, because I understand what you're saying. But if we're going to be this hyper-vigilant community and threat assessment is always paramount and officer safety is paramount in the department, we care about our officers, blah, 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 blah. Lord, you've known me 20-some-odd years. Why is it that on a midnight shift, when an officer gets a 911 hang-up call to a house that he has been at, the house has got a history. When they pull the premises up with the address in, you can hear the dispatcher scrolling. There's so many calls there. And that officer says, call them back. Oh, we don't call 911s back. Why not? Well, if there's something going on, if the perpetrator's busy killing people, he ain't going to answer the phone. The thing is, so you're willing to send me to my partner to a 911 hang-up at 3 in the morning, where it might have been accidental. These people aren't expecting the police. Their cordless phone battery went dead, which will call 911 automatically. But now they look out the window. At 3 in the morning, here's a 6'4" black man dressed all in black. Because, we don't park in front of the house, so they're not going to see the police car. Now, I'm shocked. For what? Because we wouldn't call back? Because of a hypothetical. So, I look at some of these policies that we do and we say and we introduce to the public and we say, well, this is our policy. And then I look at the practice and principles of it that I know to be true. And I have to invoke James Baldwin to say, I can't believe what you say because I see what you do. You're sending officers to 911 hangups where the officer has no intel. Once we got an officer dead on the front porch accidentally, and a scared resident who is now barricaded, we have no problem now calling SWAT. We'll call everybody in the world to come now. But we wouldn't make that initial call. We wouldn't take that one moment. And so the police departments, whether it's the dispatchers or the officers or the policy, we are just as much to blame as the community is on many instances, to where you don't know every officer. I don't want to be treated by officer asshole that you just dealt with. Don't treat me like that, because we're going to have an issue then. And I understand the community doesn't want Stan to come out and treat their condition like I just treated the one I worked the day before, because it's the same scenario, but it's not the same event. So when you build that we keep going back to that trust, that credibility, that talking, when people can identify with you, they will talk to you. That's one of the reasons we got so many cold cases in this country, because the citizens don't trust the police and won't talk to them.
It's just they don't put more police officers in the community walking the beat, you know, but then again, there's a lot of them scared. Mm-hmm. They're being conditioned to be scared, just like you said. I can tell it when I talk to officers. I'm going to pass out a card trying to get students in my class, because I figure if I can train them on non-deadly force, they're letting people die. That's how I look at it. But it has to start at the beginning. So how do you deprogram an officer and reprogram him? Now, don't even come out with AI now. That scares the crap out of me, too, because computers only going to do what you program it to do. Mm-hmm. But we're humans. So how do you deprogram them, put them back through the academy or teach them? Because some people shouldn't be officers. Some people shouldn't have carry a gun in the bag, mm-hmm. because they got that stuck in their head, like when I was in the military. People from some, not everybody, but some guys I've met from deep down south, is living for what his great-great-grandpappy is taught this mm-hmm. all down the line, and they never left that community. So when they come into the real world, they bring that same attitude. So I think that is the biggest problem with a lot of officers. I don't think everybody joins to be a bad cop, mm-hmm. but then you got some people, they got a chip on their shoulder when they put a badge and gun on and got the authority from the state that they can do and please what they want without nothing happening to them. That's where the problem is. And then when you don't, and that's where the street credibility comes in, because one bad apple, one bad cop that comes in and abuse people like what I seen when I was young, and I didn't trust cops. I think you might know Tom Carter, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, he's a good friend of mine. I would go down with him any day. He's a good cop. And there's some other good cops. I would stand down, and I don't need a weapon. I mean, I might get killed too, but I would protect him the best that I could because he's a good person. But when you see cops out there that don't care, why are you working? Go flip hamburgers somewhere. You know, if you don't like your job, get another job. Nobody's making you do it, so why come to work with an attitude and hate everybody? See, that's what I can't say. And like I said, I don't have bombs with cops. It's just that what I've been seeing on TV a lot makes me think, you know, and it bugs me, because it's a question. When will I run into that bad one, the guy that wants to prove something? Because I'm 6'1", you know, I'm a pretty big guy, and, you know, I'm quite sure that, you know, I used to, you know, a lot of cops know me because I used to train a lot of people here in Lower Pax Township back in the day. So as where I live at Lower Pax Township, I feel safe.
Yeah.
I go into Harrisburg, you know, it bugs because they don't know me. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah.
They don't see me. So that has a lot of street credibility. Like where here, I see cops, they know me, I know them. I'm comfortable.
Sure. And that's a friend.
Nervous.
But I say the media, that's one thing I'm not giving the media, and I almost dropped the F-bomb. I'm not going to give the media a pass. Black media, white media, conservative, liberal, I don't care. These people do not care about my life, John's life, Claire's, John. They don't care. They want ratings, views, likes, and clicks. And they purposely drive a divisional wedge into everything, because it does stand absolutely no good to do an anti-police show for ratings if I don't get the pro-police people and vice versa. So they understand. If we can divide these people, we get them fighting for their side by referencing our story, we're getting twice the clicks. And I think the media in this country has done a damn good job at dividing police and the community, fueling the flames on both sides, stopping meaningful legislation and dialogue on both sides, because these politicians are bullshit, Republicans and Democrats. They're not going to propose a bill unless they get a lot of likes and clicks and media time. And so that's why we don't get solutions. There is no division, really, I think, with the police in the community, because police officers are community citizens, and citizens, by and large, respect the police. You've got some that don't like the police, that's fine. I don't like everybody and everything either. But I think the media, particularly Facebook, when folks listen to these uneducated, unskilled, do nothing, and I'm going to say this, folks can get upset with it, these so far gone, over-the-top black folks who hate anything that's not black, and these white folks who are MAGA everything that those are the bullshit people. Somewhere in the middle are the same people who happen to go away from a Facebook post and say, let me research that. Why aren't they calling this show? We've been doing these shows 5 years, and we go hard where nobody wants to go. We've done shows with the president of the Proud Boys before anybody knew who the Proud Boys were. And Dr. Fred, Claire, John, everybody that's on this show is real 100, and people can call 646-716-4621. Press 1, we'll put you on. And Dr. Fred, what you're saying is 1,000% right. But I will make sure on this show, I will call out the media, whether it's your local newspaper, your local affiliate. I dealt with the media on murders. They don't care about the witnesses' safety. They want to get a story. If somebody came up to stand at a murder scene, just say, hey, Officer Mason, how you doing? All the cameras were trained. So I started telling everybody who knew me, if I'm working a murder, don't speak to me. Do not come up to me. Because I don't need you on the news because your image is seen talking to me. Because they'll make it look like officers are collecting clues. And you're asking me how my daughter's doing. See, this is where we have to understand how the media works. Forget all the political games that people play. They're there for likes and clicks and ratings. And they have fueled this division, and they're the principal catalyst behind most of these problems we're talking about. John A., you wanted to jump in here, bro?
I did. Hey, I want to step back to what Dr. Fred said, because he hit on something very important. He hit a key in that. I don't know if you realize he did or not. Policing on foot in a neighborhood is so far from making loops around it in a car. When I came on, we still had a bike patrol. We had talked as a department at that time about employing a program where officers would park the car for 2 hours and walk their beat. Now, the department never enacted that, but I did. I'd get out, I'd walk the Nashville Housing Project. I'd just walk through. I wasn't going on a call. I was just walking through. It completely changes an officer's perceptions about who he's policing and how he polices them by getting out of your car for an hour and walking around.
Absolutely.
And talking to people.
Absolutely.
When you take that power away, that's what it is. You take the power of the car and the belts and everything else. You walk around like another person in the community.
You know, John,
that's it.
And not just officers, though. City council people, mayors, and by God, police chiefs. And don't do all your walking in the daytime. I went in a roll call one night, and there was a guy there wanted to ride with me. When you got in the car with me, my first question to you was, I didn't like dogging. If you're riding with me for extra credit, I couldn't say no because the department had a ride-along policy. But if it's just for college credit, you want to ride 3 hours, you don't care about the police, why am I wasting my time with you? I could have an equipment bag sitting there that's more useful to me than they are. Let's just be honest. And this guy rides with me, and he requested me on the rider for me, wanted to ride with Stan Mason. Fine. He gets in the car. My first words to him were, what do you want? You want the dog and pony ride? I knew who he was. You want the dog and pony ride? Do you really want to know what's going on? You want the truth, or do you want the department brand of the truth? To his credit, I want the truth. Our first stop, 9th and Concord, Parkside Villages. We got out the car, and guess what we did for an hour, John? We walked. Our next stop, South Terrace. Our next stop, Trinwood, Stella Maxey. This guy today is the mayor of Waco. So if an officer comes to him and says, you really don't have an understanding of the problem, he may not have a total 100% grasp of it, but guess what he did? He did something that men and women in a uniform right now and a patrol car haven't done. He got out of a police car, and he walked. And he met people because when I walked, people came up to me. And not all of them were good citizens, but guess what all of them were? They were citizens. That's 100. I may not agree with everything that mayor does. I may not agree with all his decisions. I don't know the man personally. But I can tell you for that 6 hours, that he had the balls enough to get in a Waco police car and come ride with me, work in Hell Central. That man has my undying respect. That is respect. That is leadership. That is leadership. Exactly. That's street credit. Some of you citizens ought to be riding with these officers. See it from inside the car. What you see with a car going down the street, that ain't what's going on. You're in the car with a computer you're monitoring, one radio channel up here you're listening to, another primary radio channel down here you're listening to. You got your windows rolled down so if somebody screams help, you don't miss it. You have so much going on in that car. Y'all just see a car go down the street. But for the good officers, there's so much mentally going on in that car that you literally exhaust a lot of times. Why aren't you riding with your department? Now, if we talk about street credibility, let's talk about citizen credibility. If you're an expert on your department, who's your chief? Who are the three officers, the midnight, day shift, and afternoon shift that work the beat? Do you know their names? What are the sergeant's names over that district? Do you have a citizens on patrol program? If not, why not? Have you ever been in the police department? Other than to do something negative. See, now,
how active are you in the neighborhood association?
That part right there?
Yeah. Yeah. If your goal is to really engage yourself in your community, then it's being a part of your neighborhood association. It's doing some ride-alongs. It's making sure you know who your officers are in your neighborhood. So that there is that interaction, that connection. You know, everybody pushes towards what have the officers done for me lately.
Mm-hmm.
But that is a two-way street to a certain extent. You don't have to be zen in your knowledge of the police procedures in your neighborhood, but it is just as important as anything else. I bet you know who your mailman is.
Mm-hmm.
But you know who, I did an undercover one time. I had to ride the back of a trash truck as part of my undercover. I was shocked at the number of people that came out in that neighborhood and said, where's Larry at? You aren't Larry. How come Larry's not on the truck today? Those people knew who their trash, and I'm not talking one or two people. It was every block. Someone was wanting to know why I was on the back of that truck instead of their regular guy. So they're plugged into their garbage man. They're plugged into their mailman, but are you plugged into your policeman or woman?
Mm-hmm.
That is the same level of service, if not more important.
Let's do this in 25 minutes left. I got to go down to my big brother, John R., before I get back to Claire and Dr. Fred, because, John, so much of you is in me. I see so much when you and I talk. That I come into a better understanding of why Stan is even still alive and right here today. And I understand the community might have liked me and it protected me, but when you and I talk and you tell me why they did, bro, that when I get in my quiet place, it helps sometimes to say I'm struggling, I'm trying to make my bills meet like everybody here, but you look back over what you did for 25 years and I can get off the phone with you and say, it was worth it, and I'd do it again.
Right.
Bro.
Yeah, it's worth it, I'd do it again. All the hard burn and pain, I'd do it in a heartbeat. Because it's about your community. It's about, so the reason, here is the reason why I really like working East Waco and North Waco. A, those people were genuine people. There was no bullshit to them. They were straight, mm-hmm. Man. They could tell you how it was. And I like that in people.
Mm-hmm.
Good, bad, indifferent. I like that genuine feedback. But more importantly, those are the people on the ragged edge of society.
Mm-hmm.
They are. And if you can impact their lives and make their lives better, you have done more, in my opinion, than the bank president on the other side of town in the $2 million house, because his place in the community and his financial well-being is set. But you go to Eastern North Waco, they are literally on the ragged edge of society. They're beyond paycheck to paycheck, right? Those are the people that you can directly impact the quickest by doing what needs to be done as a police officer. 10% of crime that is occurring in their neighborhood, someone breaks into their house and takes a piece of something that they maybe had to work 4 or 5 months to get, instead of just going down and buying it like the bank president does, that is a harder impact on them. And so if you can create a disconnect as much as possible between those folks and the criminal element, that you see almost an instantaneous difference in their lives. That is why I work that part of town. That is why I chose to work that part of town.
Amen. And same with me, brother. And, you know, I didn't spend that much time in South Waco, but, you know, I love me some South Waco, because I went to South Waco and ate good over there. They took care of me at 3 in the morning. I could get some of the best Mexican food anybody would ever want to get, because I'd be on the disturbance, working in the disturbance, and they go out and cook while we sorting through it. You know, they go in the kitchen and cook. So, you know, I love it, man. I miss that part. But I'm going to go up to my brother John Ruff and Big John. We're at the 23-minute mark. Come on, bro. Chime in here. Add something in here.
Yeah, I want to put Dr. Fred Lazenbaum's phone on the monitor. And my question to you is about, can you explain the purpose of, and I think it's good for the audience, Choco. That's my first question. Can you explain what, from a martial artist perspective, what is the purpose of a choco?
From a martial artist, choco is to kill somebody if you want to. You know, stop and breathe, and that's what a choco is. Now, they have different types of chocos you can use. You know, one is a choco where you block off the carotid artery and have a pass out, or from the front, compressing the Adam's apple up, or come up under the neck and where you can't breathe. And I had some of those put on me before in the martial arts. So I don't teach the killer type chokeholds as certain people, you know, in the military. I teach that, you know, to have your eyes rolled back up in your head and you sit there and you can't move. That's, you know, and I know what you're going through, like in policing, it's to kill. You want to get somebody and then choke them out. If, let me see if I can explain this for you here. As long as your neck, your chin, is straight and is here, if you compress it, you will not die from this, because you can breathe. That's where your neck is, in here. You won't, because it's going to really cut off the pressure right here on your neck. But when you do it where this part of your arm here, and up under here, it don't take long to kill somebody, man. And it's, you know, and there should be banned. I don't even teach that to people, you know, but certain people I teach how to get out of it. And it's very hard. Now, you get a guy that's pumped up on weight and, you know, all beefed up, you know, when they put it on you, it's hard to get out of it. It is. And then, you know, when you find a lot of people, especially if you're laying prone on the ground and somebody does it to you, you're done. You're done. You're at their mercy. So that's a very dangerous hold to put on anybody.
Let me.
Okay. Got to follow up there?
Yeah, real quick, bro. We're at the 20-minute mark. Yeah, we got about 5 to spare. Come on, John.
Okay. So what does it mean to, and I think definitions mean a lot. What does it mean to disarm someone?
You just take away the weapon, take away the threat. The person, you look at an individual with a gun, this is where I teach. The person's not the threat, the weapon is the threat. You take away the weapon, because that can really kill you, then you deal with the person. So if you can take away the weapon, you take away the threat, but a person can still fight you, but you took away that most important thing. So when I train civilians, it's a difference. I train civilians to take away the weapon, call 911, call the police. I train military, I'm going to tell you after the show because I don't want to get that stuff. But it's not nice.
And Fred, I'm going to leave you with this, man. One of my favorite martial arts clips was the kid with the golden arm. And he never used a weapon. And they asked, he told his master swordsman, he said, your weapon is the sword. If you lose your weapon, you're disarmed. Mm-hmm. He said, mine is my arms. He said, so I'm never disarmed. So I took pride in knowing how to use my hands. I know you're probably familiar with the 52-block style of street fighting martial arts. Now is the considered a martial art. And it came up out of the prisons of New York.
But I heard about it, but I don't know too much about it.
Yeah, 52 blocks, man. It started off in the prison system.
Mm-hmm.
Undefeated person that, someone that was undefeated in shell combat. But, yeah.
But that's a quick change, John. You talk about the golden arm. Here is the best weapon you got right here. It's never going to be defeated as long as you utilize it right. See, that is the best weapon. Hands, weapons, don't mean nothing if you can't think. So like I tell people, like when I train kids, this is your PlayStation. You break your computer, nothing else works. So as long as you got this, you can think, you can fight. You have a choice. You can fight or you can walk away. You can always fight another day. But you can always walk away. So all-time fighting isn't the answer. So that's what I tell people. Like I said, now we talk after this song, then I can go take a real deal about the military. Yeah, I don't want people to say, oh, like I tell people, don't think that I'm invincible. I can get my butt kicked just like everybody else. I'm human. But the only thing that's going to happen, I can determine how bad my butt's going to get beat. Because I use this here. If it gets too hot in the kitchen, time to get out.
There you go. Let's do this. We're at 17 minutes because I want to get, I want to focus the last maybe 10 minutes or so. I really want to get into solutions because, you know, everybody here brings a lot of unique things. And the Facebook people are listening and posting and agreeing and offering a lot of insight. So the people who come here, we don't have a GoFundMe. We don't want any money. We don't even tell people subscribe. Here, we don't need it. We're going to bring you information. You seek it and do with it what you want or do nothing. But go back and read the Facebook comments because people really come up with some amazing things on there, things that we all don't think about, and they're so in tune and in depth. And I tell people, the folks that follow and comment on the show, you know, these are some of the most forward-thinking people, and it's amazing. I wonder why they aren't on CNN, Fox, MSNBC instead of bringing these talking heads on all the time. So I wanted to give them a shout out. John A., about 2 minutes, brother. How do we fix this? What do you think?
I think it takes a different mindset in the academy because that's where this seed is planted in the ground and it's going to grow into whatever it's going to grow into because that is the formative part of your police career. I think we have to restructure our thought process on policing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are always going to be mechanics. The mechanics of policing can always be adjusted, altered, corrected. There's always a better way to do things. But if you want to start, you've got to start them right. You've got to start people right.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it is the hiring process.
Mm-hmm.
Because the theory nowadays, because there is a police shortage, now it's about butts and cars. We got to have enough people to police. And because of all of the events nationally, George Floyd and everything else, I agree with there being a more critical thought process on policing. I agree with that. But you can't demonize it. You cannot demonize the profession and then expect to get quality people into that profession. Mm-hmm. So that's the hiring process. And the second part of that is we have to train them different from a mental standpoint of how they do their job. And we can fix the mechanics of how they actually police, but it's that mindset that they come out with. And to me, that's it.
I appreciate that, brother. To caveat the last week's show, and I know you were doing the part of the program in West Virginia, If we're going to teach them the mental, then we need to start practicing what we preach and be concerned about officers' mental health. And I'm talking to politicians and the police chief and the police unions right now. So if we want them to change the way they think, then maybe we need to change the way we, as leaders or politicians and political influence in the police community, we need to change how we think about them. These are human beings. They're not checkers or chess pieces or pawns to be disposed of and thrown away. So, and that's to the politicians and to the police unions who do nothing but endorse candidates who give nothing in return for mental health and suicide prevention for police officers, I will call their asses out on the show all day, and they can call up there. I'll bring them on. And if they're doing something, they can say it. So, I agree with you, bro.
Hey, there are some union reps out there that I deal with, and I'm certainly not going to mention it, and there are several across the country. Before they will even allow us in the door to talk to their membership, they want money in their pocket.
See?
Want the kickback.
That's a mob.
It's not about help for their employees. It's about what's in it for me and how much money.
And that's a mafia racket. It's not a police union. It's a mafia racket. I said it. They're been out of shape. Stevie Wonder can find me with Siri on social media. I ain't hard to find. So they can come at me, and I'll deal with that. But let me go down. Dr. Fred, brother, I hope you'll come back, man. I was glad to have you, man.
Well, thanks, man. It's an honor, man. You're the man. I'm on your show, man.
Now, you're a bad man. You're a bad man.
But yeah, I'd be glad. Just let me know, man. Todd, man. I enjoyed it. You know, the constructive, conversation going on.
Mm-hmm.
And these are solutions that can make this country better. Because everybody wants the same dream. I don't care if you live in a billion-dollar neighborhood or in the ghetto. Most people want to just raise their kids and live a decent life. Now, it don't matter how you can, get to my family. You always got to find one or two people in the family that go to the dark side.
Mm-hmm.
We all got them in our families.
Yep.
But majority of people are good people. Don't treat people like the other bad people. Give people a chance. Get to understand them. Walk the beat like you were saying, what y'all used to do. Get the people in the neighborhood so the police, people know who the police are. Then when you got a problem, they don't have a problem talking to the police.
Mm-hmm.
But who wants to talk to a cop when you got a bad experience with them? You don't trust them. So that's all I got to say. But anytime you want me to say, you got my number. And I was hoping your sister would be listening to it. But the grandson was going to class this morning, so she's going to be there.
Oh, okay. All right. Let me go up. Big John, John R., we go for Claire going to close the show. She didn't know. She going to be in the hot seat today. So we're going to let her in. I know she can handle it. But John R., my man, Ace in the hole. Come on, brother.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you to the guests as well as the co-hosts. Great show. I hope people got something out of this. And I think you guys really laid a lot of things out there. And I'll just say, man, about consistency. And one of the things that someone said to me, how do you get along with this officer? He was a CO, correctional officer. And he said he was like the biggest butthole. And I said, he's here for 8 hours. I could take my cell apart, put it the way it's supposed to be. When he's gone, I'll put it back the way I want it. And I said, the one thing about this dude is, when I say consistency, he's not going to beat me for 1 minute of recreation, and he's not going to give me 1 minute of extra recreation. He's going to do it 1 hour, by the book, that's it. Too many times, like parents, there's confusion with cops. You got a parent who want to smoke weed with their kid and then turn around and discipline. You got a cop who want to be a good cop one day, and then when he's with some other cops, he's something else.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be consistent
mm-hmm.
all the way around the clock. So if you're going to be a hard-nosed cop, be a hard-nosed cop. Don't try to be Mr. Nice Guy when you're by yourself or you're with your regular partner and get acting another way with other cops. I'll shut up on that.
All right. Let me drop down. Claire Van Wolfenstein.
What's up?
Your maiden voice. Take us out.
I was actually just looking up on CBS News, police in the U.S. killed
64 black people in the first 8 months of 2020, and these are their names. And there's a list of everyone. Juan Jones, Claude Washington Fain III, Harold Spencer, Michael J. Rivera, Darius J. Tarver, several people. And I think that's what needs to change, obviously. But the way to change that is, like we talked about, community policing. But it all starts in the academy.
Mm-hmm.
It all starts with your training. You have to be trained to not just be a good person, but not think of everybody as such a threat. Because these people's names matter. These are lives that we're not thinking about. And these are either unarmed people, they're black people, they're white people, it doesn't matter. But we're not thinking about them. And we need to realize that in the police academy, instead of being trained on, like I said, the threat assessment, or this lady with the walker, what's she going to do with it? Let's think about the people that we're walking in front of and say, how can we solve this? How can we as a community, solve this issue? Not just, well, this guy has a gun, or this guy doesn't have a gun, or this Dr. Fred, 6'4", and I'm scared of him. Okay, let's take the time and talk to Dr. Fred and see, well, what's he about? What's he trying to hand me? Because he's trying to hand me a card. He's not trying to pull out a gun and put it in my head. You know, we don't need to be so scared that we're worried about what Dr. Fred handed me. We don't need to be so scared that we're worried about, okay, John R. Didn't you say you've been to jail for 24 years, prison? Okay. So when I look up your police record and I see that you've been to jail for 24 years, to prison for 24 years, am I scared? Or is this a person that may have been through some shit? Excuse my language.
No, you're okay on this show.
That needs to be taught. Why not bring it back to the training? And instead of showing all those war videos, let's bring somebody like John R. in and talk about community policing.
Don't just bring me in. Bring this panel in, because we all have something to offer. And I think that you talk about assessing situations. I walk through my neighborhood. Everybody I see coming toward me, I'm assessing them. And I think I told Stan about, I look at people's sneakers, and I said, okay, he don't have his business tied tight. He got his pants hanging off his butt. This dude ain't really prepared to fight. So I assess everybody. That's just a natural human instinct. The problem, Claire, and I'm saying this to the panel, is that they got all this MMA stuff out there, and they got people like Dr. Fred, and you see a guy 6'2 get his butt kicked by little Claire to death.
So
you have to be careful how you assess situations, thinking you're going in and you got this sweet little girl, and this little girl, people have seen her at the academy, hit the bag and kick the bag, and she's a bad little joint. You know what I'm saying? So I, you know, you got to be careful, man. You know, even with teaching to assess people, it's a natural instinct. And I know John probably did his job just based on instincts and experience. And the academy can't teach you that. That's me.
The difference, John R., the difference is you have to temper that with common sense. You have to apply life experience, right? But it's also common sense. You can't hyper vigilance. You can't put somebody into a state of hyper vigilance and then expect them to be able to use common sense.
But then,
that's what I'm saying. It's okay to be on edge, because I understand that Fred could kick my ass. I get it. You know, he's 6'4", and whether he is martial arts trained or not, he's probably going to kick my ass. I'm, 5'5" and 150-pound woman. He's going to kick my ass if he wants to. All I'm saying is take the hypervigilance out of the police academy, putting these, I don't know, all ages, all genders in front of a big screen and saying, if you want to be a cop, you got to be prepared for this. Yeah, that could be the worst thing that ever happens to you, but that's not every day.
Claire, come and take my class. You don't get your help by nobody. You know what? They did a study about 10 years ago, and they talked to a bunch of felons who had assaulted police officers. These are people who have either been to prison, some were on probation, some were on parole. And it was they did a study, and it was traffic stops. And thank God this, and it wasn't a police study because it got to the truth. And they asked them, why did you, what made you think you could take this person? And not all these guys were pumped up with iron. They beat the shit out of these officers. The one consistent thing they said, it had nothing to do with whether they were black or white or male or female. That had nothing to do with whether they made the determination to try that officer. They said, I looked at where their equipment was on their belt. Did it look neat and organized? Were their shoes shined? Was their uniform ironed? How did they talk to me? If they looked like they were sharp, I didn't try them. If they looked sloppy, if you've got a fourth safety on your gun, that means you got to pull that stomach up before you can activate the other three safeties in the holster. They tried you. And all these officers didn't make it. So officer presence, from putting your equipment on to shining your shoes, because if you don't take enough time to iron your uniform, you damn sure don't give a problem. You don't care about Stan's call or Stan's problem or your department because you're representing the department or your city. So officers, if you want to step up your survivability, fix your uniform. Fix your presentation. Fix how you treat people. Fix your reputation. And you know what? The easy part is if you don't have one bill button, at least you still got a chance to interact with that community. You'll live a lot longer. Trust me, you will. So with that, we're going to get out of here. I appreciate everybody, you know, for being here. This was great. This was great as always. Claire, say goodbye to everybody. Close us out.
All right, everybody. Hey, it's been a great show. I had fun talking to everybody, and I'm glad everybody was here. And hope next time we have some more callers.
All right. With that, we're going to get out. Everybody, appreciate you guys. Love you guys. Everybody be safe. Later.
Recording stopped.
Brother Anthony, Brother Fred.
Yes.
You know, I